Good News Ministries of GNM.org. It's the Catholic place for growing your faith. Good News Ministries will provide you with faith-building reflections, virtual retreats, prayer resources, and lots more. All of it is free. Visit GNM.org today. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Yeah. Here it is. Here it is. Welcome, everybody, to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. Glad you could join us tonight. Where faith and reason meets every Wednesday between 10 and 11 p.m. Beneath the Surface, bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. We are broadcasting live from the WCAP studios at 980 a.m., which is live streamed on TuneIn and WCAP.com, and will eventually end up being podcast on sites throughout the internet. Tonight, my fellow truth seekers, we delve beneath the surface on the question of what is a person? What is a person? And lucky for us, right across the console from me, I happen to have one of those subjects, Mr. John Tudorus.
Hello, it's great to be a person.
Isn't it great to be a person?
Yes, although I would argue that I'm more slightly diagonal than immediately straight across.
Okay, that is true.
Yes.
But for the sake of the radio audience, you are right across from me.
I'm totally right across
from
you.
See, look, I'm moving this way.
Oh,
so now
we're right across.
Yeah, now
there
it's like
no
a straight
diagonal.
Line. Straight line going on here. But it is great to be a person, and if you weren't a person, you probably would not be able to reflect that it is great to be you.
That is correct. I would not have intellect. I would not have will.
You would not have an intellect for self-reflection.
Yeah.
And so there is no question of non-persons as to whether you are happy, whether you are sad, whether you're glad you're alive.
Yeah.
Non-persons sort of just live.
Yeah. Yeah. I would definitely agree with that.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, we're going to talk about that and a lot more beneath the surface tonight. Our phone number, if you would like to join us, is 978-454-4980. That's 978-454-4980. Or you could give us a comment at facebook.com/fellowtruthseekers. That's all one word, facebook.com/fellowtruthseekers. Okay, well, John, where do we start? How about, what is a person?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, they're basically, at least from the way I understand it, it boils down to one of two main philosophies. Either the person is a veritable ghost in the shell.
That would be dualism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's actually, a lot of people don't think of it in those terms, but the underlying premise leads to a lot of people's ideologies these days.
Yeah, let's stop right there. Before we go on to the other one, dualism, you said a ghost in a shell or a ghost in a machine. The person is understood to be the spirit or the invisible inside parts.
Yep.
And the body is like a shell or a covering.
Yeah.
Or like clothing.
That goes right back to Plato. Plato thought the spirit was the perfection in the person, and the material body was almost like an evil.
Yeah.
And the soul was just trying to escape out of the body.
It was a temporary prison-like state to some dualists.
Right.
But to dualists in general, the soul is the person, the body is a covering, it's temporary, it's accidental, it's not essential to the person.
Right.
And so when a person dies, like you said, most dualists believe that the human being or the person is freed and they can now experience real life as it should be.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay. That is not the traditional Judeo-Christian understanding of what a person is.
That is absolutely
In fact, you find this kind of dualist personal philosophy in Eastern philosophies.
Yeah, Eastern philosophies and some Western, too. Obviously, you mentioned Plato and some of his close followers.
So some of the ancient Greeks, as you said, and also Buddhism, Hinduism,
yep,
and that kind of thing. And hence, dualism is, it fits into the possibility of reincarnation.
Possible. I mean, Plato himself, as far as I understand,
he didn't
believe it.
Yeah, he didn't believe it.
But Pythagoras did.
Okay. But it's fitting. It could. There's nothing that would contradict a dualist understanding of the person, which is simply a soul, perhaps going into some... It depends.
Right, I
know what you're thinking.
Yeah, it depends on someone's idea of what the soul is in essence. In Plato's mind, reincarnation wouldn't be possible, but if you think that the soul itself is somewhat malleable as far as its essence,
then
yes, you could.
It could go and form other matter,
yes,
and you could become something else, as some of the Eastern philosophers. Okay, so then that's dualism. What is another understanding, a popular or a common understanding through history of what a person is?
Well, that actually would go right back to Plato's immediate successor, if you will, and that's Aristotle. And
okay,
that the person is a body and soul composite, meaning,
yep,
what's the term you use, hylomorphic reality?
Yep. Hylomorphic union of body and soul.
Yeah, and so that they're actually inextricably linked, and that the soul is the form of the body, and by form we just mean that it's the body actually takes its cue, if you will, from the soul.
So the soul informs the body and makes the body, makes, let me put it this way, me and you are both made of matter.
Yes.
Right? And we share the essence, humanity, but you're you and I'm me.
Yep.
And what makes you you and me me is our soul.
Yes.
It informs the matter that becomes our body.
Yep.
And so, okay, so the soul is the form of the body and its life principle.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So then you have two understandings right there of the human person. One is that the person themselves is the soul and the body sort of a temporary covering that you're better off without. And this hylomorphic body-soul composite understanding of the human person, which, by the way, is what traditional Judaism and Christianity understand the person to be, we are body-soul composites. It's like having heads and tails of a coin. You don't have the coin without both. You don't have the human being without both.
That's correct. That's correct. The spirit would be considered the first principle of the person, if you will.
Right.
And that the body takes its cue from that, but you're right. The whole person is both.
And the body is essential to the substance of the person.
That's correct.
All right. Now, I will add to that, and some ancients had this understanding, but particularly this is popular in the modern world, and that is materialism. That the person is simply a material body and nothing else.
Yeah, that's in some ways that's almost a modern invention. It just completely ignores too many things.
It ignores a lot, but if you begin with a materialistic philosophy, a sort of a scientific positivism of reality,
yeah,
then it makes sense in following that logic that persons would just simply be walking, talking bodies until they disintegrate at what we call death and go back into the ground and become other things.
Yeah, that just leaves way, way too many unanswered questions.
And it's a bit depressing, isn't it?
Very depressing. That's it.
That we exist for maybe a few decades, 8, 9 if we're lucky.
Yeah.
And then the bodies go back into the ground and there is no consciousness after that.
And what's very fascinating, of course, about that type of ideology is that there'll be a fair amount of intellectual thought given to the material minutiae of a person, how certain things function. But as soon as it comes to the bigger questions, such as ideas, thought, which are immaterial in themselves, you can't measure them, all of a sudden the intellectual rigor just seems to go out the window.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get into that after the break. But I think we're missing something here, and that is, in these three models of what it means to be a person, we've actually described what it means to be a human person.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Because
not necessarily a person in and of itself.
Correct.
Which brings us to the question that I actually, it was part of the advertisement. Are all humans persons, and are all persons human?
I would say that all humans are persons, but not all persons are human.
Bingo.
Person itself is the larger category.
Which one do you want to start with? The fact that all humans are persons, or the fact that all persons are not human?
Well, I will say it is chef's choice. You shoot.
I didn't realize I was the chef.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's start with all persons are not human.
Mm.
All right. Now, we just went over three common models throughout history of what a human person is, but not necessarily a person, because some persons, at least faith and philosophy will tell us, do not necessarily have bodies.
That's right.
Elaborate.
Well, starting from the philosophy, yeah. Aristotle would say that he reasoned that there had to be beings that have intellect and will,
yeah.
and that do not have material bodies like us. Because they don't have material bodies, and that they would be pure spirit as far as their nature, they would actually be more powerful and more intelligent than us. Because of that.
Well, we
and you call them separated substances.
Yeah, separate substances. So we get our knowledge through our senses and into our minds.
Correct.
And then we begin to understand things. And, you know, understand the essences of things and try, we're able to create thoughts and ideas and sentences and arguments and all that kind of stuff. But it's kind of a laborious process of learning for us physical humans. It's not immediate like separated substances.
Separated substances would have an infused knowledge by their nature. So, and just take a little slight side tangent here. So, when we think about time, like how we learn things progressively through time,
right.
Well, in the ancient philosophy, they would say time measures change in matter.
Yes.
Well, these spiritual beings, these quote-unquote separated substances, have no matter. They're outside of time.
Therefore, they have no change.
They have no change.
Yeah. Yeah, so they are created as they are and always be.
Yes.
Because there is no growth, there is no maturity, there is no matter for that time to make that occur, because it's simply because they are, like you said, purely spirit.
Yeah.
Now, Aristotle called them separate substances. When Christianity came on the scene, and, of course, Aquinas took Aristotle, and all kinds of nice things happened between faith and reason, philosophy and religion, we began to understand angels as being persons without bodies or personal substances without any physicality.
Yes, and the important thing on that is that it wasn't something new. It was more of a development of what was already there. For example, in the Old Testament, we see in the book of Tobit,
yeah.
there's the angel Raphael guiding Tobias on his journey, and he doesn't actually really need to eat or anything, so there's a certain appearances that are kept up where he's interacting with the material world, but there's something very strange about him where he doesn't actually need the sustenance of the material world
yeah.
the way human persons do.
Very interesting. And there are appearances of several angels in the Old Testament, isn't
yes,
there?
Yes, there are.
Yeah.
And some of them are these very fantastic, strange visions, and sometimes they're just these really mysterious interactions with people. Tobias, of course, is one example. The other is the three mysterious strangers, if you will.
Visitors,
that,
yeah.
Visitors that come to
Abraham. Yeah.
And which are somewhat representative of the Holy Trinity, but at the same time...
Sort of an anti-Trinity.
They're generally thought to be angels. There's this really interesting icon where they have these three angels, and the title, if I'm not mistaken, is the Holy Trinity.
Okay. Well, angels appear in the Old Testament, and they're talked about a lot in the New Testament. Angels are understood to be persons without bodies.
Yes.
So they're not human persons, they're angelic persons.
Yes.
Which then it sort of leads us to ask the question, what is in common between physical persons and spiritual persons? And that is...
Spirit, intellect, and will.
Spirit, intellect, and will. As Boethius called them, an individual substance of a rational nature. I just to sort of simplify that and say a subject with intellect and will.
Yeah.
We're not only an object, like things or animals. We are a subject. We're a person. And hence, every person has intellect and will. Now, let me ask you this. Is the intellect and will the person itself, or does the person have intellect and will?
Well, we would say the person has intellect and will. The person is really the simplified essence, so to speak, and then the intellect.
Well, what does that mean to most people?
So
simplify the language.
Yeah. So we're talking about that there's the singular one, right? So there's
the one
perfect unity
substance
of that person.
Yes.
And they have certain aspects, right? So if we look at our material body, you would say, well, that's person, that's Paul, but Paul has an arm over here.
Yeah.
He's got an arm, he's got feet, he's got his afro. you know, these are all aspects of Paul that we see, but there's only one Paul.
Only one Paul, yeah.
Right.
So then the person encompasses the entire body-soul composite.
Exactly. And as far as the human person, right?
Yes.
And
I'm going to challenge that after the break, and I'm going to challenge that with... not only people in persistent vegetative states, but people in their embryonic state of life.
Yes.
And people who have had many transplants, hypothetically, in the future, if people have a brain transplant.
And what about the nature of person in the creator?
Well, we'll get to that, too. So all of these questions and more as we delve beneath the surface on the question of personhood. What does it mean to be a person? Across the console from me is the person John. I am the person Paul. Glad that you can personally be with us tonight. We'll be back right after this break. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. Even say why leaving me lonely still. I Am, I Said, there by who?
One Mr. Neil Diamond.
Diamonds. I Am, I Said.
I'm surprised you know that record.
Are you kidding me? I sing that song every time I play out. I don't know if the audience knows that I'm a one-man band. I play guitar and sing oldies but goodies, and that's certainly one of them. I do several Neil Diamond songs, in fact, but I know that song was chosen by our producer, Cindy, because it has to do with personhood.
Yeah.
I Am, I Said. Now, it's interesting you mention that, because I wanted to mention that mysterious word, the most mysterious word in the English language, is the word I.
I think we take that for granted.
And I don't mean I as in E-Y-E. I mean the word I as in the letter I. Isn't that you want to elaborate on that first?
Well, I know from our prior conversations off the radio that you could probably fill up a whole show just on the notion of I.
Yes. But it just seems like I denotes personhood. I mean, what other word could denote personhood than referring to oneself as I? And what's interesting is if you look at the things that we say relating to that word, there's usually possessor and possession. I have an arm. I have a leg. I have a thought. I ran. So there's things that I does, right? I do things. I will things. I choose things. The mysterious question is, with all of that, what is the I that has, and the I that chooses, and the I that thinks? What is that mysterious I, Mr. John? Don't give me that face. Give me a good answer. How would you describe I?
I am happy to be here. I will say this. I have not given near so much thought to the notion of I as you have.
Well, I didn't want to go into a whole diatribe about that tonight, but I do distinguish, in my mind at least, between I and self. Self,
yes,
is what we, in a sense, the I seems to control. I almost hesitate to say possess, because then that would make the body as a thing, and I don't think the body is a thing, because I believe that in body-soul composite, hylomorphism. But when we say I have an arm or I have I have a leg, we are making a distinction between I and leg, I and body.
Yes.
We even can say, and this is the most mysterious thing, we can even say I have a soul.
Yeah.
And what the heck would that? How do you distinguish between I that has and soul which has had? Which makes me think that perhaps what we mean by I and soul are actually distinct from each other. The soul is the form of the body. Perhaps I is the consciousness of the body.
I would have to say that the I is the entire being.
I don't know about that.
Yes, I have a soul. I have an arm. I have a leg. I have a mind. All those are unified by one word, I, and yet that one I has many aspects.
I choose.
Yes. I have will. I have intellect.
So you're saying that my leg, my big toe, chooses when I say I choose?
No, it's the person that chooses. See,
yes.
There's an aspect of the person. You know, there's the will that chooses.
But it's I that uses the will.
Yes.
Or utilizes the will to choose.
I stubbed my toe.
Yeah.
I chose to eat the apple pie.
Yes. Yes. So and when I refer to I and what you refer to I, obviously are two different things. Even though they are the same nature, they are two different things. There's John I and there's Paul I.
Yes, which is fascinating. And what's even more fascinating is that how that one I happens within a common humanity.
Yes. Yes, there are...
We have a common nature.
Almost 7 billion eyes on the world right now.
Oh, you're like my 42nd cousin.
And we are all descendant from... Even science would say that around 120,000 years ago, we are all descendants of two original human beings.
Yeah.
To which the entire world are descendants of. But anyway, getting back to this notion of personhood and what we call ourselves... We are persons in as much as we are subjects with intellect and will. Just to cover what we talked about a little bit to go over it from before the break. Persons aren't necessarily physical, so there are angelic persons, there are human persons, and there are God persons. Now, God persons, obviously, if you're a believer in God, are uncreated, are infinite and eternal, and are perfect. All persons, that are created persons, whether they be human persons or angelic persons, are simply reflections of the eternal Creator Himself.
Yeah, I would agree. In the way that if you were to look at a Norman Rockwell painting,
yeah,
you would say, well, that's a reflection of the talent of the person, Norman Rockwell, the artist.
Yes.
So in this way that God is like the artist and we're the creation and we bear some imprint of the Creator.
And here is part of the mystery I was talking about earlier. Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, the only time where somebody asks God what his name is. God, and of course in ancient times, the name actually described the being. God simply said, I am.
Yeah,
there's the mysterious I.
Yes, isn't that fascinating? That two words could convey so much.
Yeah, and if you think about it, all created persons have to say, I am, and then fill in the blank.
Right.
To describe what we are. I am short, I am tall, I am Paul, I am John. I am dark-haired, I am Italian, I am Irish, I am female, I am male, etc. I am smart, I am dumb. There's a whole slew of adjectives that one would have to understand to know the person, because we're all different from each other in that respect.
Right.
But with God and the name that he actually gave himself, the divine name.
He's simply being itself.
There is nothing after the word am.
Right.
He is personal being, infinite and eternal, without definition.
Yeah.
Without boundary.
And so I would say with that, if God is perfect being, the perfect I, and has perfect personhood, then all of the persons that come from that perfection would actually be only analogous to the perfect personhood, the perfect
right.
being of God himself.
Right. It's sort of like if you were to paint a beautiful painting, you would say that those persons in that painting are analogous to the living, breathing human beings that are here.
That's right.
On this side of the painting. And yet, they're still, you could still call them persons, even though they're not
yeah.
really like us, but they are in a sense.
Oh, there's a portrait
yeah.
of Uncle Bob. There's Uncle Bob over there, but
yeah.
it's not the fullness
right,
of Uncle
it's
Bob.
It's a reflection of him. So, are animals persons? We talked about God is the uncreated, infinite and eternal tri-personal being, which with no definition and no boundaries. We talked about angelic persons that are pure spirit, with no bodies, and they're pure intellects. We talked about human persons, which have both physical and spiritual components to them, i.e. a body-soul composite, and so that we're physical persons. Are animals persons?
They are not.
They're not persons.
They are not. Although they may have some person-like characteristics.
Person-like characteristics.
Yes.
Yes.
For example, if anyone's owned a pet like a dog or had multiple dogs, they know that they would say that dogs have quote-unquote personalities.
Yes.
So there's certain aspects of their being that are different than other dogs.
Really should be called dogalities.
Yeah, dogalities, right? Or catalities.
Or animalities.
Animalities. But they don't have intellect the way that we do, right? There's limits to it. They have a certain mode of communication. We know that. Various species do.
Mm.
We can see that. Even some species have been very fascinating, like how elephants will mourn their own dead, which is kind of fascinating itself. But they don't have intellect and the will in the way that persons do.
Mm.
They don't have that immortal soul the way persons do.
How do we know?
How do we know?
Yeah, how do we know? I every time I say this, I get in trouble by especially by the human sex that isn't male.
Yeah. Well, there's some males too that will argue that.
They would argue it, but they're not as emotionally involved.
Yeah,
it seems,
and they're not giving very good evidence either.
Yeah, yeah. So that animals they're certainly physical beings. Would you say then, just to make it simple for radio's sake?
Sure.
You have angels that are spirits without bodies.
Yeah.
You have animals that are bodies without spirits, and you have humans that are sort of the bridge between both heaven and earth.
Kind of, yeah.
Spiritual and bodily.
I like that old definition of a human person. Was it Socrates say a man is a rational animal?
Aristotle, yeah.
Yeah, Aristotle.
Yeah. A rational animal. So that we have, obviously, we have an animal component.
Yeah.
We're animated bodies, and yet there's something rational and there's something spiritual within us that virtually any philosopher can see, or
yeah.
any thinking person.
Yeah, just even someone of a very regular common sense intellect, they'll just...
Let me write down some of the things here that I have... let me talk about some of the things here that I have written down about just some of the general differences, the essential differences between animals and human persons. Speech. Animals have signatory cries and gestures, whereas humans have propositional language.
Mm.
Now,
do you want me to give you a signatory?
Yes, go ahead. There you go. Now, that is a dog signifying what?
I'm hungry.
Okay. And that's just it. Animals do give signs in their signatory gestures, but humans, in a sense, do too. Like when the stomach growls, it means it points to the fact that I may be hungry, right?
Yes.
Or when I have a smile on my face, it's a sign that I might be happy. Or if you hear a woman screaming or a man screaming, it could be a sign, it probably is, that they're afraid of something. So we also have signatory gestures, but we have symbolic propositional language that rises way above the physiological gestures like other animals have.
Yeah, it does. It is kind of fascinating language. Also, the ability to create things. We're not talking about like a bird might build a nest, but that's instinctive. That species of bird always builds the same type of nest in the same type of place, generally speaking. Whereas you get a human, a human can build all sorts of different homes in various places.
We have igloos, right? We have igloos, we have teepees.
Yes.
We have Trump Towers.
Yes.
We have all kinds of different homes.
Made of different materials.
So in other words, a bird can't say, hey, let's be creative and do something totally creative, different than what this nest looks like.
I want to build a Gothic-style bird house.
Yeah. It just doesn't happen. Birds don't have that creativity because they have nothing spiritual inside of them that rises above their physiological instincts.
That's right. Okay. I would agree.
All right. So knowledge, generally speaking, theirs is animals is sensual and instinctual.
Yeah.
And ours is sensual and intellectual.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we still have instinct, too.
Yeah.
But we have the, if we allow it, our intellect can actually govern our lower passions and our appetites.
And that's what it's meant to do.
That's right.
That's the proper order.
And if it doesn't, well, then people might say, oh, don't be such a monkey. You know, you're being less of who you are.
Yeah, you're acting like an animal.
Yeah.
If you allow your lower nature, your passions, and even your emotions get the best of you and govern you rather than what you understand in your intellect to know to be true and good, then, of course, you're acting less like a human and more like an animal.
Yeah.
So we have that that intellectual, spiritual part of us that rises above the physiological instincts. And we can just give an example. If you're an animal and you're extremely hungry, you haven't eaten in a while, and there is this rabbit and you're a carnivore that's going by you, he's pretty defenseless, you're not going to sit there and deliberate and say, is this the morally right thing to do?
No, I'm going to crouch down behind the tall grass, and I'm going to sneak up on the rabbit, and I'm going to try and catch it and eat it.
A very hungry dog doesn't say, wait a minute, my master's going to feed me in about a half hour, and I'll just leave that little guy alone. I'm sure that his parents...
Only the most well-trained dog.
No. So, yeah, we have the ability to rise above our physiological instincts, and this is what makes us human. We have intellect and free will. And that's why it's free, right?
Yes.
We don't have to follow our lower base nature.
Yeah, we can choose.
Yeah, we have the ability. And this is, of course, what the moral life is all about. this is a fascinating one between us and other animals. Our relation to time and space. Our relation to time. Well, animals' relation to time. Let's start with them. It's confined to the perceptual presence. Think about that. An animal's conception of time is confined to the perceptual present, whereas ours, we have the ability to mentally transcend the perceived present. In other words, you and I realize that we had a past, we will have a future, and we're sort of on this particular mark right here in the ruler of our lives. We know that.
That is kind of fascinating.
Isn't it?
Animals are just there.
They're just there and they live in the presence. And that's all they are aware of, is the consistent presence. I mean, you can hear the music. The video can't hear the music, but you and I can with the headphones on. So we need to take a break, but I want to explore this a little more, the difference between, and I want to get into the perceptual here and now, too, versus what we have as humans, having a human soul. 978-454-4980 is our phone number, the BTS hotline. If you want to get involved in our conversation, love to have you. You're listening to Beneath the Surface at WCAP. Paul Morano with my guest, Mr. John Tutoris, and Cindy behind the glass, and of course, Jen, who is doing the video. We'll be right back right after this. We are back. 978-454-4980. Beneath the Surface, WCAP, till 11 o'clock. And then after that, Cindy's Vinyl Vault. You don't want to miss that. Okay, on Beneath the Surface tonight, we're delving beneath the surface on the question of what does it mean to be a person? This notion of personhood. And so far, we talked about the notion that it is a subject with intellect and will that is able to understand, seek meaning. Persons seek meaning. That's one of the trademarks of what it means to be a person. We come out of the womb after Mama and Dada, and maybe no, the fourth word virtually all human beings say is why.
And they say it for about 1 to 2 years straight.
Yeah.
Why?
Sometimes it's what, sometimes it's why. What and why, meaning and purpose. Think about that. What means meaning, why means purpose. We are meaning seekers and purpose seekers as persons.
Yeah, we're instinctive philosophers.
Yeah. Which points to the fact that we are more than simply physiological bodies that live on instinct, programmed to survive. We certainly are. We need to eat, and at least a certain amount of us need to procreate in order to survive. But we are more than that, and that's what we're talking about tonight, the meaning of personhood. Before the break, we were saying some of the distinctions between animals and persons, and the relationship to time and space that we have is different than that of the animal. Whereas the animal is confined to the perceptual presence, they're also confined to their immediate environments.
They are.
That is their entire reality. Now, if you're a baby or a little kid, sometimes that's the case with you too, right? Your entire reality, all you know, is your home or your yard or your sandbox, right? Or your bed.
Sure.
But, of course, when we mature, we get to understand that even if we don't see it, that there's a whole world out there that that we're not perceiving.
That's right. They still have the potential for the intellect and will. And, of course, that goes to the point you brought up a little earlier. You know, for example, people in a persistent vegetative state,
yes,
in a coma, maybe someone who wasn't fully developed. But still, the potency is there. Their nature is still there as a human being.
Let's unpack that a little bit, because a lot of people today would challenge whether a person in a persistent vegetative state is actually still a person, or whether an embryo or a fetus in their a human being in their embryonic state is actually a person.
Sure.
So tell me about what you mean by their nature is a person and they have the potentiality to be an adult person.
Well, that's right.
What does that mean?
If you don't mind, I'd like to borrow a little something from Ricardo Montalban of Fantasy Island fame.
Yes.
This is much later in his life. His health had gone, stopped doing all the entertainment. No longer was he playing con. And someone asked him, says, well, you know, how do you know that the person in the womb is real? He says, well, if you take away, because he was a devout Catholic, if you take away my faith, you take all this other stuff, I'm just going to use my reason. And he says, when was I? And he go back in time. Was it now? Was it at this certain point in time? Was it, you know, when I was born, when it was in the womb? He says, I go all the way back to the moment that I was conceived. And that is when I was I.
Yeah, and we have ultrasound sonography now. And the way I do it in my classroom is I take them as an adult, and I say, 10 years ago when you were, say, 15, when you pointed to a picture, could you truly say that was you? And they say, yes. Well, what about a picture of you when you were 10? Yes. How about a 3-year-old picture? Yes. How about 2 days after you were born? If you were to point at that picture, is that you? And they would say, yes. And then some are lucky enough to have ultrasounds, right? Because they live in the ultrasound world today, era. And so what about that ultrasound that your mother took when you were, say, 6 months after conception? Was that you? Yeah. How about 4 months after conception? If you were to point to that. And what if we had the technology to take ultrasounds that are 3 to 1 day after your conception? If you were to point to that picture, is that you? And, of course, they'd have to say, yes, the moment that I began to exist was my conception, and the moment that I ceased to exist, at least as a body-soul composite, is the moment of my death. And you're, scientifically, there is no arbitrary point between those two points that you can say that there is no person there.
That's right. At the moment of conception, the entire package of DNA is right there. I mean, it's in seed form. And think of it like an oak tree, right?
Yeah.
You get this mighty oak tree, and you get this little acorn. Well, at some point, that oak tree was a tiny little acorn in seed form. But then, given the right environment, all the DNA that ultimately became that mighty oak tree sprung from that one little seed.
But first, it becomes a bush, an oak bush.
That's
and
right.
Then a shrubling.
That's
and
right.
Then what's the next word?
Oh, a sapling.
Sapling.
Would be, yeah.
I don't know my tree
but
words.
But all these various stages.
Stages of growth, sure. Well, what about the end of life? A lot of people would argue that once the higher brain function ceases, the person can no longer utilize that part that we talked about that distinguishes us from all other animals, the intellect and the will. They're in a persistent vegetative state. Are they still, can we rightly still point at them and say that is a person?
Well, even to a certain degree less than that, and probably much more common, is someone elderly with dementia.
Yes.
Which is not too uncommon. I'm sure at some point people listening to this would have probably known or do know someone who has it. And so would you say that that person is no longer a person because they don't have the full capacity of their intellect?
So as long as the person isn't alive and they're not being, excuse me, they're not being fully kept alive by a machine, if their vital signs still are working or still have hope, then you'd have to at least assume, if not know, the person still exists.
Yes, the person still exists, even if the capacity of everything isn't working to its fullness the way that we know it, they're still a person.
Now, your personhood, or your person, is your identity, yes?
Yes.
Okay, suppose you tomorrow get hit in the head and you get permanent amnesia. You don't remember a darn thing about who you are or anything else past that. Are you still John Tudorus?
Still am.
You're still John Tudorus. I know you're a generic person.
Yeah.
But somebody would say, well, he's no longer John Tudorus because all of his memories are wiped out.
He's not the John that I knew. He's a little different.
Yeah.
You know, and to some degree, they're right. They're right. You know, I don't talk the same way I did. I can't carry on the same conversations that I did. But the essence of who I am still has not changed. So we would say that there's damage to the material interface, if you will, of my personhood.
The brain.
Maybe my brain has some brain damage, but my spirit itself, that animating spirit, is still there.
So you're still John. You wouldn't have to change your name.
Yeah.
Even though you don't remember a darn thing.
Yeah, and actually in ancient philosophy, they would say that the spirit is actually the real repository of our memories and intellect, not just, you know, it's not the brain. And so we could almost reason from that even a person who isn't functioning properly here,
yes,
in the material world, spiritually, they're actually there.
They're still there.
Their memory's there. Everything is intact.
You know, we have been so inundated by the philosophy of materialism that so many people think that when or if the brain is damaged and those personal faculties are no longer operable, the person themselves no longer exists. And you would say that's folly.
I would very much say that's folly.
Mm.
Absolutely. Okay.
All right, go ahead.
You go ahead.
All right, well, I was going to challenge you on this because, as you know, 100 years ago, it was nobody dreamed of the possibility of a heart transplant or any body transplant, really. All right? There is now... There are now doctors seriously talking about performing head transplants.
Yes.
There is one who is going to do it in Russia, and I think because of their medical laws or what have you, I think he's going to do it in China now. But there is a man who is a paraplegic, hasn't been able to move in years, but his brain is still healthy. And he's hoping that this doctor is hoping to do it, to take his head and place it on the body of somebody who died and is brain dead, but quickly, because, of course, the organs deteriorate very quickly. And so somebody who dies and who is brain dead they would switch the heads and the bodies. They'll put the healthy head on the healthy body. And, you know, the question is, if this does in the future, and, you know, there's no evidence that this will ever happen to human beings, but if it does, who wakes up from that operation? The person of the original head or the person of the original body with a new head?
Pure speculation, but I'll say the wherever the head resides.
Really?
There the person goes.
Now, doesn't that contradict what you said a little earlier about the personhood being in the spirit itself and not necessarily in the head?
Right. And I would agree with that. But in so much as that it would appear that if this something is something that could be successfully done, the intellect is moving, and the intellect resides in the spirit. So I would say that ethically, I don't think it should ever be attempted.
Right.
But if it were to happen somehow successfully, then most likely what you would see, the way I would think it, is that it would actually be the person where the head came from.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So the identity, the personhood, you would say, is more prominent.
Yes.
In a person's head.
Yes.
Than it is in the rest of their body.
I would say yes.
Okay.
But even then, how does that really work in relation to
how in the world
spirit, which doesn't necessarily have the, by its nature,
yes,
a material essence? I mean, humans are different, of course. But, you know, for example, if when someone dies and they're a disembodied soul and they have no matter at that moment, what do they look like? We don't know.
Well, of course, matter, spirit doesn't have a look.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right, we only have, about 5 minutes left. What direction would you like to go with this question? What is a person?
So now that we've explored pretty well the nature of what a person is, so just to recap, they have spirit, intellect, will. When it comes to human persons, that they're a hylomorphic reality, meaning they're a spirit-matter composite.
Okay.
That there's this intimate union between the two. So, when you get to certain social ideas that are somewhat prominent now, for example, like your LGBT, let's take the idea of transgender, right?
Okay.
So there's this idea that somehow, because a person feels that they are one gender versus another, even though their biological sex communicates something different, that it's almost like this dualism, right?
Yes.
That they say, well, on the inside, my spirit, I feel feminine, even though my body is male.
Yeah.
But that again ignores this union of who they are as a person.
As we said earlier, body-soul dualism would be fitting for reincarnation, but it would also be fitting for this notion of transgenderism.
It would. And by extension, I would also add the lesbian, the gay, even bisexual,
in the
sense that, so for example, the whole human person is geared towards, so how do you create a new person? Well, you have males, you have females, and then they come together. So what is real love, right?
Right.
So love has to be in order towards truth.
If you believe that the body has meaning,
yes,
then none of those things rationally make any sense.
They wouldn't, because how can one give fully of themselves, not just in their intellect and their will, but also physically too, if there's no compatible parts to do so?
Right. But if you're a dualist, you might think, erroneously we believe, that the body has no meaning to it.
Exactly.
It's just we create all the meaning that we want within our own bodies.
So if I say it doesn't matter what someone is, I can love, if I'm Sue, I can love Sally, right? Well, or, I can just marry the tree because I love the tree.
Well, I think this is huge. You're putting on something, you're talking about something huge that we do a whole show on, and that is the repercussions just the consequences of these models of what it means to be a human person.
Yes.
If it's dualist, then you can do whatever you want with your body for the sake of pleasure, because it's not really you. It's just an object or a thing that you can use and manipulate. However, if you believe, like we do, that the human being, the human person is a body-soul composite, then the you, the person, is manifested through the physical body because they're one.
And I would add, yes, and with that, it's important to say that there's an objective nature to that human person.
And an objective meaning to human acts and behaviors.
Exactly. And that would just lead to, I suppose, something that's less, it's always been in fashion, if you will, as far as throughout all of human histories, and that's things like economies and war, right?
Okay.
So if we have a good understanding of the human person and we respect that, well, inherent in that is the natural law that's built into us, right? For example, don't steal from someone, don't murder someone, right? But greed is bad universally, no matter what religion, culture, time, place. These things are universal.
So if human persons have an objective nature, meaning that their body is actually essentially a part of them, and all bodily acts have objective meaning to them. If bodies have meaning, and they're not simply a covering, then what you're saying makes sense.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
There is a natural law that all human beings must adhere to fundamentally in order to flourish and be happy.
That's correct. That's correct. And by happy, we mean to come to a full fruition of who they're meant to be by their nature.
Your potential is actualized, to say it another way.
That's right. Potential is actualized. We become more fully who we are meant to be.
Very interesting. It has a lot of ramifications, this, what it means to be a person.
It does.
Particularly a human person.
Almost every single action that we can think of that we do stems from our nature.
And our understanding of who and what we are.
Yes.
Very good. Thank you, John. Thank you, everybody, for listening tonight, Beneath the Surface, here at WCAP. What is a person? Paul Morano signing off with my guest this week, Mr. John Tudorus. Hope you have a great week, everybody, and we will delve beneath the surface with you next week. So long.
This is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tours Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.